Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 071391 et al. FedEx Home Delivery, a separate operating division of FedEx Ground Package System, Incorporated, Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Cruz for the petitioner, Ms. Isbell for the respondent, Ms. Bushy for the intervener.
Mr. Cruz.
May it please the court. For over two decades, the business model of FedEx Home Delivery and its predecessor company has been predicated upon providing vibrant entrepreneurial opportunities to independent contractors who own and drive delivery trucks. Throughout that time, the board has consistently declined to relinquish its jurisdiction. The court should reverse the board for two principal reasons. First, this case is controlled by this court's decisions in CC Eastern and Corporate Express, which the board altogether disregarded. And second, there are five contractual rights under the operating agreement which are utterly inconsistent with employee status, not simply intention, not factors to be weighed, but utterly inconsistent with any plain language meaning of the word employee. Beginning with the first point, on its facts, this case is indistinguishable from CC Eastern. In CC Eastern, this court looked to eight factors. Seven of those eight, we have square factual findings by the board in this case, are fully satisfied. The eight factors the court looked to in CC Eastern were, number one, that they owned their own trucks. At JA 39, we have a factual finding to that effect. Number two, they set their own start and end times. Number three, they took breaks when they chose. Number four, they determined their own routes. Number five, they were paid by the job. Number six, they were not subject to company disciplinary procedures. And number seven, which CC Eastern stressed was the most important, they retain the rights to hire other drivers and use their trucks for other purposes. On all of those, we have square factual findings from the board that those facts are present in this case as well. The only factor the court looked to in CC Eastern that is not present here is in CC Eastern there was not a uniform requirement, whereas there is here. But CC Eastern also explained that requirements that are driven by the dictates of customer service do not transform a contractor into an employee. In this case, the owner-operators are making home deliveries. They must access people's personal homes, and the uniform is integral to having access to the home. The second point, there are five contractual rights that are utterly inconsistent with employee status.
Let me ask you one question about CC Eastern. At the end of CC Eastern, the court focuses quite strongly on the problem that the board had made completely inconsistent rulings with respect to the other company, which the court described as identical to, and in fact, which the board confused for the petitioner in that case. We obviously don't have that problem here. In this case, the board, as you said, has consistently ruled one way with respect to Federal Express.
Well, it has, although the board disregarded its own precedent in numerous other cases, and our brief describes that at length, including the Argex case, which had very similar factors of being able to hire other drivers. And the facts and situations, while the board has consistently endeavored to treat FedEx's independent contractors as employees, its own precedent is all over the map on this. But in addition, there are five factors that are utterly inconsistent with employee status. First of all, incorporation. Many of the contractors have incorporated. If you look at the two facilities in question, the Boston and Wilmington facilities, two contractors who were single route contractors, Robert Fonseca and Si Hoon Oh, both formed corporations and the contracts were with the corporations. Nonetheless, what the board has done has held essentially that those corporations are members of the bargaining unit. I would submit that it stretches the word employee, which is the statutory word that determines the board's jurisdiction, beyond recognition to conclude that corporations are employees. But that's precisely the situation.
That can't be the test because we have a piercing of the corporate veil. No one has ever ruled that these are really corporations. All they had to do to become corporations was to file papers, and you could file out those papers, and maybe they would be appropriate, and maybe they would be inappropriate. But until a court or a state agency reviews it, the mere fact of filing the papers can't resolve the question.
But there has been no argument.
Is that wrong? I mean, it can't be that that company could ask its employees to just go ahead and incorporate themselves, and then, you know, pay the salaries to the corporation, and that's enough without some other review of whether this is merely a corporate veil problem.
It may be right or it may be wrong. I'm not aware of any litigation on a question of whether one can pierce the corporate veil to get beyond. But there has been no suggestion, there has been no argument, there is no proof that the corporations in question here are a sham. And in fact, the experience of FedEx, both at the time the record was formed and in the proffer company-wide.
What if it was a person who owned the truck, but that was the only factor? No other factor. He owned his own truck. FedEx governed every single thing that he did all day long, by the minute, had somebody ride along with him at each stage, controlled his uniform and everything else, barred him from selling his route or changing his route or anything else, so that there were no other factors. But that person filed to incorporate himself, and FedEx contracted with that corporation. Would that be a significant factor?
It would absolutely be significant. I'm not aware of any precedent that would allow piercing the veil, but what one would have to demonstrate there was that the corporation was, in effect, a sham, and there's no suggestion there. And, in fact, if you get to the second factor,
Do they pay corporation taxes?
They pay corporate taxes. They pay filing fees. They have all of the incidents of being a corporation, there's a reason for that.
They pay taxes both on the corporate profits and on their individual profits? Are they pass-throughs, or what are they?
It varies driver by driver in terms of what form of corporation they file, but the corporate form certainly carries with it incidents of taxation. And the easiest way to observe that this is not a sham is looking at the second factor. This is not simply a corporation in name. The second factor, they own multiple routes, they hire drivers, they hire helpers. Now, if one thinks of a typical employee, for example, to use a legal context, an associate in a law firm, an associate in a law firm is an employee. That associate doesn't have the option to hire multiple associates to get paid for, say, four associates' work, and then to subcontract out that work to multiple other associates at a lesser amount. I mean, that's not what an employee does. Over a third of the contractors today, nationwide, own multiple routes, which means they are employing drivers, they are having profits and losses, and they're, at the end of the day, whether they make money is not dependent on how many hours they work.
I know we're both, go ahead, ask the question. It's the same.
Is that information actually part of the record?
Yeah.
The information as to what the situation is today is necessarily not part of the record. We submitted in our conditional motion to remand a proffer that if there were a remand, that the trend that was evident in 2006 when the record was formed has only continued and accelerated. What is in the record is that in 2006, at the two locations in question, there were five owner-operators who were incorporated in Boston and Wilmington, and there were three multiple service areas, and there were two route sales that occurred at these two locations. Now, at the same time, we submitted a proffer to the board the board erroneously excluded that nationwide the number of contractors who had incorporated in 2006 were 872, which was 23% of them, and the number of contractors who owned multiple service areas was 838, which was also 22% of them. And so that was the proffer. And what the board did is it excluded all of the evidence of nationwide entrepreneurial activity, and then turned around and said, we find no evidence that people have exercised entrepreneurial activity. If you look at a third aspect, the ability to choose your replacement and to flex packages to any other contractor. If I'm a contractor, I don't have to show up to work one single day ever. If I have a contract with FedEx Home Delivery, my contract is delivered to the packages in my proprietary area. If I hire another driver, I can never show up to work. If you go back to the associate in a law firm, I'm not aware of any associate in a law firm who can hire a replacement to come do his or her job.
What's the evidence that's in the record on the number of additional helpers hired by people in the two locations?
There's not a specific number in terms of the additional helpers, but there were three contractors that had multiple service areas, which necessarily, if you have more than one service area,
Those were excluded from the bargaining unit.
They were, but we would submit that only underscores the board's error, because the court in CC Eastern and Corporate Express held it is the opportunity for entrepreneurial gain that matters, not the regular exercise. And what the court did is said, well, everyone who exercises entrepreneurial opportunity is excluded, and that's a tautological definition. Well, gosh, the folks left must not have exercised it.
But let me ask you, though, the drivers, as I understand it, who have multiple routes or who hire other employees were considered supervisory employees, right? And so excluded from the bargaining unit.
That's correct.
What about the people that they hired?
The people that they hire are employees of the multiple unit contractors.
So they would be part of the bargaining unit, because I understood the regional director to be saying that they could vote for the union.
They cast conditional votes, and the regional director did not resolve that question, and it ultimately didn't matter for the election that occurred. So they were allowed to cast a conditional vote, and the regional director put it on.
And conditional on what?
Conditional upon resolving the question about whether they would be treated under a joint employment principle as employees of FedEx Home Delivery. But the regional director didn't resolve that, said there's a question about this. I'm not going to resolve it at this point. If I could,
we'll give you another chance. Don't worry. We're very unlike other places, we're very loose on time here. With respect to the multiple routes, the people who have multiple routes, are these multiple routes within the same geographic area?
Typically they are, although not necessarily.
Okay. So in this area, which is a relatively densely populated area, do we know what, in order to have a multiple route, you have to go into an area that somebody else doesn't already have, isn't that right? Or is that right?
Well, that actually gets to the fourth factor I wanted to get to, which is the ability to buy and sell routes, which occurs frequently, and that's one of the ways that contractors acquire multiple routes, is they buy another contractor's route. In this case, the record demonstrates there were two route sales. One, that there was a profit of between $3,000 and $6,000 above and beyond the cost of the vehicle, and the other, there was a profit between $11,000 and $16,000.
Well, when you say profit, you mean above the cost of the vehicle,
yes.
But you don't mean
value.
There was a value.
Well, the value.
Value is
better term. Don't mean profit in the sense of profit and loss compared to...
No, I simply mean that the value of the proprietary interest, the exclusive right to deliver in that area...
But you don't know whether the people who sold, in fact, lost a lot of money in their investment.
So they may not have
an entrepreneurial right to invest in losing routes.
And it depends upon their business acumen. Yeah. I mean, that's the essence of an independent contractor. If their costs are very high, then they may not be making a great deal.
Do we have any evidence that anybody's business acumen was good enough to make a profit? There's no evidence one way.
Well, we have nationwide a thriving network of independent contractors who are acquiring multiple routes, who are buying and selling multiple routes. We have in the record here that the gross revenues in this area ranged from below $60,000 to over $250,000.
The NLRB says, well, of course, if you have multiple routes, you have more sales, you have higher gross revenue. It doesn't necessarily mean more profit, obviously.
But if one assumes rational actors, that they are acquiring multiple routes because they see an opportunity for profit, if you think about the question, the statutory question, are these individuals employees? To go back to the law firm associate analogy, it boggles the mind to suggest that an associate at a law firm could approach a friend of his or her and say, I want to sell you my job. That doesn't make any sense. Employees don't sell their jobs. If you have a proprietary interest, if you're running a business, and that's what FedEx Home Delivery has built its competitive model on, is incentivizing the owner-operators to run businesses. And
could you give detail on how Tremblay used these catalogs? It appeared to be building up business, but business on that route, and how did it work out?
It was on the route. As he traveled about, he would give out his own card and encourage people, if you have something that you want to FedEx, call me. And he would also deliver mail order catalogs, things like L.L. Bean or the like, and encourage people, you know, buy more mail order, which would necessarily increase more FedEx deliveries into his area. And so the fifth factor that is completely inconsistent with employee status is inheritability. If a contractor passes away, the contract provides that the route is an asset of the estate, which means if you think of a law firm associate, the idea...
I don't remember reading this point in the briefs. Am I wrong about that?
It is not articulated in the briefs, but it is found in the contract at JA 741.
But the other side hasn't had a chance to respond. Was this argument raised before the board? Inheritability?
What was raised was that it was a property right that was saleable, that was entrepreneurial, and that was held by the individual. The specific aspect of inheritability, I am suggesting today at argument on the face of the record, is inconsistent with employee status. Employees don't get to bequeath their jobs to their heirs.
But we have a 10E problem with respect to an argument like that. If it wasn't raised before the board... And we've been pretty specific about how much has to be, what degree of specificity has to be. I'm not saying it's a bad argument, but we have a jurisdictional problem.
Well, I would submit that...
With respect to the argument about a proprietary interest, right?
That's exactly right, Judge William.
No more powerful than the facts you stated up until just this moment? Or is it more powerful?
I think it is yet another aspect that is inconsistent with employee status. And they're all part and parcel of the same ultimate question that this court focused on in CC Eastern and Corporate Express, which is there a real opportunity for entrepreneurial gain? And each of these are aspects of that. I mean, FedEx has the entire business model has been based on incentivizing contractors to run businesses, to make profits, and to do so more efficiently and more effectively.
Thanks very much. And we'll hear from Ms. Isbell. All right.
May it please the court. My name is Kelly Isbell. I'm here on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. The fundamental question in this case, as this court explained in Local 777, is how much control FedEx has over the means and manner of the driver's day-to-day work and whether those drivers work for themselves or work for a wage provided by FedEx.
If the driver can every single day farm out his work and his truck, how much control does the company have over him?
Under the operating agreement, which is the same nationwide and applies to the two units at issue in this case, there's quite a bit of control. But remember, the drivers you're talking about who farm out their work completely are multiple route drivers or multiple route owners, and they are supervisors, and they're not in the unit. I'm sorry?
The right to farm out is not limited to multiple route holders, is it?
It is not. But in the two units at issue in this case, there are no single route drivers who completely farm out their work.
But there what you're saying is that every single day, when the driver gets up in the morning, he or she can decide that he or she will or will not drive.
On a day-to-day basis?
Right.
Well, Your Honor, FedEx, for example, requires that all substitute drivers be approved by FedEx. So if you wake up on Tuesday and don't feel like going in,
an approved substitute, you can't. So you need some advanced planning, right?
Right. You have to provide service Tuesday through Saturday. You cannot decide you're going to take a day off.
You or your substitute.
The substitutes have to be pre-approved. The single route drivers in these units, I'm sorry?
Have to be which?
Have to be pre-approved by FedEx.
Pre-approved. Okay. And the approval process, what does that involve beyond the DOT regulations?
As far as the record indicated, it was the DOT regulations, and they have to comply with all the standards in the operating agreement. So that is all the driver release, the part of the operating agreement that relates to driver release of packages, the customer service requirements, the safe driving program, all of that's in the operating agreement, and all of the substitute drivers have to comply with the operating agreement standards as well.
They have to drive safely, they have to deliver what they're supposed to deliver, they have to do what has to be done.
They have to wear the FedEx uniform, they have to wear the FedEx badge, they have to scan the FedEx packages.
Is the FedEx uniform part of the results and ends, or is it part of the means and manner?
Well, FedEx would argue that wearing a uniform is just part of customer service requirements and that you shouldn't look at that.
Well, you look at it, but it doesn't right. Count for the board.
Well, it doesn't get the drivers out from under FedEx control just because it's customer service requirement.
Nobody. The point is that there's means and manner, results and ends, and then we have sort of an intermediate category, which, from the point of view of any entrepreneur, are going to be critical in terms of the results and ends, but they may look like means and manner. And I would think clothing and earrings and the logo would all reflect on that.
FedEx's entire business is based on these drivers delivering their packages. It's not like Dial-A-Mattress, where the business is having a mattress business and you contract out to drivers. Everything the drivers do reflects back on FedEx. FedEx puts these guys out as FedEx employees.
Well, everything they do in terms of its external impact, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean,
solely their external impact. In other words, it's not like a worker in an office who's not seeing customers, or a worker in a factory who's not seeing customers. It's someone who's out there for the public, right? Like the employees of McDonald's franchisees who are reflecting on the brand name of McDonald's.
Yes. But FedEx's
McDonald's,
entire...
not a brand name of the franchisee who is their employer.
Right. But FedEx's entire business model is based on these deliveries by these guys scanned into...
McDonald's, their business model is based on the performance of their franchisees.
And its
correspondence to the criteria imposed by McDonald's. It's true throughout the franchise industry, of course.
Right, but the customer service requirements, I mean, I think what you're asking me is all of these, is there anything that's not customer service related that FedEx requires these guys to do? I mean, FedEx has control over the day-to-day business, the day-to-day work of these drivers. I mean, in addition to how they look and how they, what time they deliver packages, everything is controlled by FedEx. They have a route
not
they deliver.
Route, not their route, not their sequence.
Not the sequence.
Not their starting, not their ending, except that there's a ceiling on the ending.
There's a ceiling on the ending. The routes are the same every day. FedEx
except
decides
to the
what
extent
packages.
That by flexing exactly. And by farming out, they're all avoidable.
FedEx decides which packages they're going to deliver, and every single day, if the FedEx manager decides that a driver has too many packages, FedEx will flex packages away. I mean, FedEx controls how many packages a driver has to deliver every day. FedEx requires the scanner.
It has a maximum. It doesn't, because the driver can flex anything away that he can flex away or farm out, anything that he can farm out.
The driver could.
There's a severe limit on what FedEx actually controls.
Well, FedEx reviews every day to see how many packages drivers have assigned to them and whether or not there's too much for a particular driver. FedEx, when they go on these customer service rides, evaluates not only professional courtesy and how a person looks, but how much time they spend at each stop and whether or not there's too much or too little work assigned to a particular driver. FedEx drivers can flex away packages, but I believe there was only one single route driver in these two units who flexed on a day-to-day basis. People do it irregularly.
CC Eastern makes pretty clear that it's the right vindicated by some example of actually being exercised that is enough.
Now we're talking about entrepreneurial opportunity, correct?
Right.
And CC Eastern says that there has to be a real right.
Yes, and which can be evidenced by as little as one exercise of it.
Well, what the board found in this case was that the entrepreneurial opportunities for these single route drivers are speculative and limited. The route sales evidence for these two units.
I mean, the people who do it, right?
For selling routes, there have been two examples of route sales, and there was no evidence.
Under CC Eastern, that would seem to be double the minimum number needed.
Except that, in this case, there's no evidence.
Double the minimum number needed to make it a factor. It's not double the minimum number to make it relevant.
That, right.
The problem in CC Eastern was the board had given it zero relevance to entrepreneurial activity. And the court said, well, if there's an example, then you can't give it, and that could tilt it in that factor in favor. But why do you not think there's entrepreneurial activity here?
I'm sorry?
Why do you not think that there is entrepreneurial activity here?
There is. The board didn't say there's no entrepreneurial activity. The board said that the evidence of route sales presented to it at these two terminals was too speculative. There is no evidence of any value attached to the route as opposed to the vehicles in these two terminals.
I was interested in a sentence on page 46 of your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is the one that talks of, I guess this is the sale by driver Young. It says that sale included a van, but Young had purchased the van for $34,000 to $35,000 and had $26,000 in payments to go. In other words, the route sale simply reimbursed him for the $10,000 he had already spent on the van. Is that what buyers of property normally do in terms of deciding how much they're willing to pay? They feel an obligation to reimburse money that's been paid by their vendor?
I'm not sure the buyer thought that.
Huh?
I'm not sure that was the buyer's thought, but perhaps it was Jung's thought.
What on earth does, how is it possibly relevant to the contention that there wasn't really a markup for the route?
Jung also abandoned one route. I mean, if his routes had actual value, why did he abandon his other route? I mean, Jung had two routes before he became a FedEx supervisor. He sold one, which is what we're discussing on page 46 of my brief. He abandoned the other without selling it to anyone.
Maybe he'd been much more successful at building up the one he sold.
Maybe, but
that doesn't seem at all relevant.
Well, except that if you're looking at whether or not there's a proprietary interest in these routes. There have been, FedEx presented two instances where routes were sold. There are five instances where routes were abandoned. FedEx gives away these routes for free. What the board found was that...
I was thinking about that argument, too.
Yes, Your Honor.
My understanding is that in the franchise industry, it varies from situation to situation in terms of whether the franchisee at the inception of the relationship pays anything to the franchisor or doesn't. But I think it's pretty much universal that they can market them, whichever the case was in terms of the original acquisition. So you can hardly say that in that situation, because there's some franchise operations going for free, it follows that the ones who acquired theirs for free haven't got an entrepreneurial opportunity.
The board found that there's not enough evidence at these two units of real entrepreneurial opportunity. And
is it lack of evidence about entrepreneurial opportunity or lack of evidence about the exercise of it?
It's lack of evidence, according to the board, it's lack of evidence of the opportunity.
Well, does that make a particle of sense? Right? I mean, if people do it, if the right is there in the contract, why isn't it there?
The right is there in the contract. The board found that these two instances where they couldn't attach a value to the route were too limited to prove that there was an actual...
I'm sorry, why couldn't they attach a value to the route?
Because the two witnesses couldn't say how much they sold their vans for versus how much they sold the routes for.
I mean, that's often the problem in the sale of a business, that almost any effort to allocate the price between different elements is arbitrary. So, the vendor doesn't have any particular interest, except possibly for tax purposes, in making some sort of allocation.
Perhaps. But I would just like to remind you that whether or not these root sales occurred is not the final, it's not an either-or test.
It's final in a multi-factor test.
Exactly.
It doesn't get you to the point where you can just put the great scramble in and come out wherever you like.
I completely agree. But the board weighed all the common law agency factors as it's required to by the Supreme Court and United Insurance. And it found that these entrepreneurial activities, when we're just looking at two root sales in a unit of 33.
If the board placed so much significance on the fact that there were only two, why did it exclude the petitioner from being able to put in evidence there were many more, assuming that they had that evidence by proffer, in other locations across the country?
What the board limited was the evidence, the system-wide evidence, not evidence related to these two units.
Right. Well, what if it were the case? I'm sorry. I think we're probably, again, Judge Brown and I are asking exactly the same question. What if it were the case that all over the country, 99% of the areas of the country, people sold their routes, had multiple routes, et cetera, and these two did not? Would that be irrelevant? I appreciate it might not resolve the question, but would it be irrelevant that others in other locations were able to successfully sell their routes?
I mean, in this case, yes, I believe it would be irrelevant. And here's the reason. The union petitioned for two units at two particular terminals. The board, when it's making a unit determination or deciding if something is an appropriate unit, looks at the facts on the ground in those units.
Yes,
and that's what the board did here.
To determine whether there really is an entrepreneurial activity, why isn't it relevant that others across the country with the same standard operating contract are able to turn their roots into an entrepreneurial opportunity? Now, the board may have an response. Maybe the fact is that there's something very unique. Again, I'm just assuming the value of the proffer here for a moment. Maybe there's something really unique about these two locations. And then the board could say, well, yes, in other locations they were able to, but this is very unique, and in fact, in these circumstances, these people are only employees. But I'm not sure I understand the rationale for totally excluding the proffer of the evidence.
Well, in this particular case, I mean, we're not looking at a case where 99% of all the terminals have these have wonderful evidence of entrepreneurial opportunities and massive profits on route sales.
Yeah, but now you're telling me what you want to tell me is that even if the proffers had come in, the board would reach the same conclusion. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the proffer did come in. I mean, it was accepted under the regional directors.
Right, but it was excluded. They weren't allowed to put in the evidence. And the applying Chenery here, the board did not say, even if we were to accept this proffer, we would reach the same conclusion. It did not say that, did it?
If
that were the case, then we'd be having a quite different argument today.
Right.
We would be asking the question, what if it were the fact, as Mr. Cruz said, that there were 838 multiples and that there were 823% nationwide. But we're not discussing that. So under Chenery, we can't rely on an argument that had the evidence come in, it would have not made any difference unless the board makes that argument. I'm right about the administrative law. This is like black letter administrative law, right? Yeah. So you can't rely on that. So try something else.
Here's something. The board's exclusion of that evidence is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. Okay, so it's an administrative procedural issue. The board decides what's an appropriate unit, who's in a unit, based on certain evidence. The board, its typical procedure is you look at the evidence of those terminals at issue. If the board abused its discretion, that's a decision for you to make. But the board, this is its typical procedure. It looks just at the terminals at question. Those terminals or the drivers in those terminals.
I think that the opposing brief points out that in some other cases the board did look at nationwide exercises of entrepreneurial activity or multiple routes or hiring of employees,
etc. Perhaps speaking of a reference to RPS 3, Roadway Package Services 3. And what the board in that case found was that the two terminals at issue.
Is that a predecessor of this company?
It was. FedEx bought RPS. What the board actually said there was that there were only, at the two terminals at issue in that case, there were only a few instances of forced sales by RPS. That was not enough to show that the drivers had a proprietary interest in their routes. And in addition, by the way, there are 5,000 drivers. So the board didn't rest its determination in that case on the lack of system-wide evidence. The board, in making a determination about those drivers, said that there were only instances of forced sales. It did not say that RPS should have provided system-wide evidence.
I know you're way over your time, but I do want to go back to something Mr. Cruz talked about, which is that it's very unusual to have a circumstance where an employee can have somebody else come in and do their job. And as I understand the regional director's decision here, she exempted three who had multiple routes and said they were supervisory employees, but allowed their employees to vote conditionally for the union. I understand that wasn't resolved. But what's your response to that? Because, in fact, would the argument be that the employees of these, quote, supervisory employees are FedEx's employees?
I mean, as Mr. Cruz pointed out, the issue was not resolved. And you'll notice in the board's order there's a footnote that says we're not relying on the regional director's finding that the secondary employees are employees of FedEx. So it's not resolved, and they are not in the unit. I mean, if the union, for example, wanted them to be in the unit, there would have to be a completely different procedure, a unit clarification petition, and we'd go through all this again. So they are not currently in the unit.
But and the ALJ board didn't make did it. Resolve that the drivers who farmed out in this form became supervisors. So they, in effect, promoted themselves.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct? In other words, it's a unilateral choice to promote themselves. Is that conventional?
They're statutory supervisors.
They're statutory supervisors, right? I mean, did they
Well, they're de facto themselves? Supervisors, too, right?
Right,
I mean, they have the power to hire and fire these people, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're statutory supervisors, and they're real-world supervisors.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it is a case where each employee has the right to promote himself.
Within FedEx's constraints and with FedEx's approval.
Yeah, getting a DOT-qualified driver and not much else.
Well, and buying a truck that meets FedEx's specifications and providing somebody to work Tuesday through Saturday. But yes, the board found they were statutory supervisors. So they're out of the unit.
You already have the truck, right?
I'm sorry?
You already have the truck.
But if you become a multiple route, if you have two routes, you have to have two trucks.
Right.
Okay, thanks very much, Mr.
Thank
Cruz.
You.
We used up. Oh, no, we have an intervener. I'm sorry.
Good morning, Your Honors. Renee Bushy for the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Local Union Number 25. I believe the petitioner's counsel hit the nail right on the head when he talked about some of the previous decisions of the National Labor Relations Board. Four different regional directors' decisions in three different units all looked at this issue and determined that FedEx drivers were employees.
You're going outside the two areas we have before us?
I'm talking about the two New Jersey decisions and the Worcester decision that were included.
You're going outside the two, at least one of them is out. Do we have New Jersey before us?
They were part of the record in this case, yes. The decisions are in the appendix, yes.
So the decision is with respect to a New Jersey unit, or there's evidence about a New Jersey unit?
There is both decisions and evidence about New Jersey units in the record in this case. To the extent the region...
I'm sorry. Okay, it's Worcester and New Jersey. All right.
Worcester and two New Jersey decisions. All of those decisions were approved by the board and found that the drivers were employees.
But we're reviewing the board decision, right?
You are reviewing the board decision. That's correct.
Your point establishes some degree of consistency.
Exactly. And prior to this, under roadway package system, there were three prior decisions reviewed by the board finding that RPS was an employee, finding that the drivers of RPS were employees as well. My point is exactly that the board has been entirely consistent over the past 20 years.
But the question
different
is,
whether, boards,
question is
different
whether
groups.
It's been consistent with our case law and also whether it's been consistent with other cases by the board, such as Argix.
I understand that, but I think the fact that in so many different occasions they've all found the same outcome shows some consistency in their decisions as well.
It does show consistency on a certain wavelength, yes.
And FedEx tries to distinguish the facts in this case from the third roadway package system decisions, RPS3. And I think if you take a look at the factors that they list in their brief, the only thing that they come up with, there's no changes in the operating agreement of the parties. The contractual relationship between the parties has more or less remained the same. All that they are able to say that's changed since RPS3 is that FedEx no longer directly provides vehicle financing, and
Could you direct your attention to distinctions between this and CC Express?
CC Eastern or Corporate Express?
CC Eastern.
Well, I think a very important part of this case about FedEx that you'd mentioned and the petitioners has mentioned is the uniform issue. And the petitioner is trying to say that they wear uniforms because the customer likes uniforms. I think intervener would beg to differ. I think they're wearing uniforms, they're using logos, so FedEx can market, build its brand name, and profit from these drivers. That's to build their own brand marketing.
That fits the McDonald's model exactly, does it not?
Well, another requirement on
its franchisees is to make money.
Well, I would assume a franchisee would have some negotiation with McDonald's in what their contract is going to be. Here, a driver.
Is that in the records?
I'm just thinking on this point that, again, it's given to them on a take-it-or-leave-it basis with no option to negotiate any part of an agreement.
Yeah, I think my recollection is we have cases saying that that's essentially irrelevant as long as the rights afforded the person are sufficient.
The difference in CC Eastern, I would argue, is the uniforms. I think that's a very strong factor in this case.
And the ability to farm out.
Well,
pleadability to farm out.
I think if you look at the restatement second 220, it talks about, that was my second point. In CC Eastern, they didn't have to show up for work. I mean, our idea of an independent contractor.
They don't show up for work here.
The difference is in the restatement, when you have a supplemental driver, FedEx still has control over that driver. Just as much, and I think the distinction is, if FedEx still controls your helper, has to approve them, they have to follow your work rules, subject to all of FedEx's rules, that doesn't really give them the freedom to hire and farm out their own work. They have to be approved by FedEx, and there's still...
More freedom. Do you have any case where a person is found to be an employee who has the ability to essentially... punt his work to another person, even a qualified ability to punt
I would rely on the fact that if they're not entirely farming out their rate. I think there are some citations.
Take Mr. Cruz's example. It would be very extreme if a lawyer, an associate in a law firm, could farm his work out to a non-lawyer, right? That would be really quite a stretch. But his point is that it's a stretch of the ordinary employee relationship for lawyer A to farm out his work to lawyer B.
I don't think it would be such a stretch if I said, I need some assistance. Can I hire a paralegal? And my firm said, well, let me look at their qualifications. Let me look at what they're going to do.
You're going through a whole rigmarole of negotiation between the employee and the employer that ultimately leads to some sort of substitution. Here, You meet criteria that are set forth in the contract, and that's it.
Well, I don't really think that's the practice. The practice that happens here is FedEx already has these temporary drivers. If you look at the record, the supplemental drivers, anyone else, is not coming from the drivers themselves. They're coming from FedEx. They're temporary employees that FedEx already hired and is giving, saying, oh, you need some extra help? Well, we already hired this temporary person, so why doesn't he work for you? I mean, I think the practice and the qualification of FedEx control, and I think the restatement supports this, and I don't have an exact case site, but I think the restatement supports that issue of it. And I do think that's a strong point in this case, that, I mean, these drivers who are supposedly independent contractors really have less freedom and less work flexibility than most employees. They are required to do their work. Their contract says we're going to make full use of your vehicle. I mean, is that a standard independent contractor? Is that a standard what you think of as independent contractor? You have to be here every day. We're going to fully use or your vehicle has to be here every day, and we're going to fully use it. We're going to go right along with you and check and see if you're fully using it. And if you're not, maybe we'll give you some more work because you're not fully using your vehicle. That doesn't sound like an independent contractor relationship to me.
Well, I think the cases do say that you can have quality control and monitoring. And as I understand it, this ride-along happens four times a year or something like that. So does that, in your view, override the independent contractor status?
Well, I think it is showing control over their work, and it's not part of a typical independent contractor relationship. They're managing the independent contractor's business. They're telling them, you need to get more work, you need to get less work, and we're going to go decide to do that. And given the other factors, I think that's an important factor, that the workload is so controlled by FedEx. I think to be an independent contractor, you need some control over your workload. You need some ability, perhaps, to work for other employers, employees. In this case, none of these employees worked for any other companies. I think that's a strong factor that shows that these drivers are employees.
Couple questions.
Okay.
On that last point, what if there were evidence that Mr. Cruz is proffering that in other places or even in nearby places, they did work for other companies?
Well,
why would that not be relevant to the determination?
Well, I think the real problem that the regional director is facing is a union files a petition to their organizing. They file a petition to get an election. And FedEx says, well, let's look. We have 3,000 or 5,000 employees, 3,000 or 5,000 former employees, and we want to bring all these people in and talk about route sales. So I think it's from a timing issue, and I think that's very important to a union. If FedEx, and I think FedEx knows it, if they can spend 6 months.
Well, I understand that that's not the ground on which if the ground of the decision had been too much burden, or this is a local union and it's not a national union or something like that, that would be an argument about abuse of discretion. But that's not the ground that the regional director gave.
Well,
the regional director's argument was it was not relevant at all.
Well, I think the relevancy argument is most strongly shown by the fact that FedEx doesn't attach any propriety value to these routes. How could there ever be a legitimate property market in these routes if FedEx is giving the routes away?
Are you saying that in the case of a franchise that's issued not for a price, even though it gives the franchisee an entitlement to sell, and even though franchisees under these conditions do sell, that's not a legitimate proprietary interest?
Well, I think there's a difference between, which FedEx tried to reply, is there's not a consideration in the agreement. There is consideration between the drivers and FedEx when they get a route, even if they don't pay for it. But why would someone else, how could a market be developed? If you can get...
Well, the obvious answer is that the driver has built it up in some way.
Well, I just don't understand how a driver would ever want to pay thousands of dollars for a route when it could just wait until FedEx decides to give one away.
I'm not a psychologist, but the evidence seems to be that on occasion it happened.
Well, I think the regional director, the relevancy issue is there really, first of all, there was very, very little evidence in these units of root sales. One of the sales was by a former manager, and the board asked for documentation on this sale, and it was never provided. So the court can draw its own inference from that. And the other one was for, which we already discussed, could have been for equity in the van. So I think there's very weak evidence of root sales, and I think there is a real issue of relevance.
Can I ask you a couple questions about CC Eastern? You
okay.
Focused on the uniform. It seems to me there were some other points, and I just want to understand them. So in CC Eastern, the court said that the company does not set specific work hours for the drivers. Do you know whether the CC Eastern was like FedEx? In the as I understand it, FedEx has a certain time you can't start before,
mm-hmm.
and a certain time that you must end by.
Correct.
Is that, do you have any idea whether that was the same in CC Eastern, or when the court said that the company does not set specific work hours, that meant there was no starting time, no ending time, and you could do it however you wanted to?
I'm not exactly sure about the times. The factors to me that seemed important about the work in CC Eastern,
I'm
refusing work.
Ones are important to you, but this is another factor that might be in your favor, so I don't think you want to just make it disappear. This is a factor that could be different, and I wanted to know whether it is.
I don't recall a discussion in CC Eastern about the start and work times.
There isn't a discussion in the case. I wondered whether in the regional director's decision there was a difference, because the court's just a shorthand for this.
Oh, in the regional director decision of CC Eastern?
Yes, right.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that
the
decision.
Court said in that case that it's up to the driver to decide whether to perform maintenance and repair, the cost of which the drivers bear. Now, I understood that FedEx bore part of the, or is willing to bear part of maintenance by contributing a certain amount of money every month through a fund.
That's right. They have a maintenance program for their vans. There's very few types of vans that these drivers pick. It's a certain shade of white they have to be in order to meet the FedEx requirements.
Also, CC Eastern said that the drivers were responsible for their own fuel. My recollection is that there's some kind of limit on cost
FedEx
of fuel.
FedEx subsidizes fuel when it gets to a certain price. I think as the NLRB brief pointed out, FedEx gives a guaranteed income of 30% to 40%.
Do you know whether that occurred in CC Eastern or not?
I don't believe it did, but yeah. I don't have the regional director
decision.
Similarly,
I take it you don't know when the court said the driver has the right to decide when to start and stop work. You don't know whether that, for example, the driver cannot decide to stop work after 8 p.m. in this case, or whatever it is, 8:30. They have to stop by 8. They have to be done by 8.
In this case.
In our case. You don't know what the situation was in CC Eastern.
I'm not sure what the situation was in CC Eastern.
No further questions, we'll hear. Well, Mr. Cruz, you took up more time than you were allotted, but we took up more of your time than you probably wanted, so we'll give you another 2 minutes. I at least would appreciate some discussion on the exclusion of the evidence and whether that was significant and how significant it was.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It is our first position that based on the facts in this case, as a matter of law, there is ample evidence to conclude they're independent contractors. It's our second position that it is reversible error to exclude evidence on the central legal question that matters, which is whether there is entrepreneurial opportunity. One of the things that makes this case in many ways straightforward is the facts are largely undisputed. And in the argument that my colleagues presented, they often avoided the factual findings in this case. But the question before this court is a question of law. What is the legal significance of largely undisputed facts? For example, on the question of hiring helpers, the board argued that, well, as a practical matter, we don't know much about that. Well, we have a factual finding from the regional director on page 29 of the joint appendix, where the regional director describes, it appears that many contractors who hire substitute drivers, so many contractors is how the facts were characterized, use the FedEx Home temp drivers or other contractors who are already trained and otherwise qualified.
That seems a little more obscure to me, at least. It says many who hire substitute drivers. So if only a few hire, 90% of the ones who hire could be. We don't know the answer.
It is not quantified, but the word many is what is used. And if you look at the sentence that follows, FedEx Home is not involved in a contractor's decision to hire or terminate a substitute driver, and contractors do not even have to tell FedEx Home that they have hired a replacement driver as long as the driver is qualified. So that's the factual finding that we're dealing with, and the question is, under this court's precedent, what is the significance of that factual finding? Likewise, on end time, I believe both the board and the union misstated what the record is on end time. At JA 475 and 482 is what the testimony was on end time. And at both of those, what the testimony was at 475 was, generally speaking, our cutoff in this particular area is usually about 8 o'clock is when our contractors usually start delivering. It's not a company-imposed end time of you must stop at 8. It's generally speaking, that's what happens. And then the follow-up questioning on JA 482 is, you'd said they generally left about 8 at night. Do, in fact, contractors finish their routes at all kind of different hours? Absolutely. And do some on occasion finish later than 8 o'clock? Yes, they do. And do some finish early in the afternoon? Yeah, there's several that get done prior to 3 o'clock. So there is no set end time. And there is no set beginning time other than a contractor can't begin delivering the packages before they're there. So that's the beginning time is when the packages are sorted and ready to be picked up, and it's up to the contractor to determine when he or she will either directly or send his drivers to go load the packages and deliver them. So there's neither a set start time nor end time. Likewise, on the question of route sales, the board argued, well, we really don't know if there's a profit. The problem is you've got a factual finding to the contrary, which is JA 38. The regional director concluded, thus, Neal's profit on the sale of his route was only $3,000 to $6,000. A couple of sentences later, it appears that, at best, Ferreira paid Young somewhere between $11,000 to $16,000 for the route, and that was after deducting the cost of the vehicle. So you've got two factual findings, that you've got a profit of between $3,000 to $6,000 and a profit that appears to be between $11,000 and $16,000. And the question is, legally, what's the consequence of those facts? With requests to the exclusion, it is interesting that the regional director in this case looked nationwide on other issues. At JA5, the regional director says, I'm looking to the issues in these other cases. It was only on the central issue that legally is dispositive that the board excluded the evidence of nationwide, widespread exercise of these entrepreneurial rights.
Mr. Cruz, if you could wrap it up, I think we appreciate it.
A final point. Each of the contractual restraints that the board and the union has focused on, this court has addressed that type of constraint and concluded that those do not transform an independent contractor into an employee. With respect to efforts to monitor the results or end of performance or to focus on customer concern, in North American Van Lines and in CC Eastern, this court held that doesn't turn an independent contractor into an employee. With respect to governmental regulation, this court held in Yellow Taxi that restraints imposed by governmental regulations do not transform into an employee. With respect to something being essential to business, this court held in Aurora Packing that that's not particularly weighty. And, for example, in the yellow cab cases, delivery of cabs is essential to the business, and that doesn't transfer them. And finally, the board and the union put a great deal of emphasis on the incentive programs that exist to improve customer service. In CC Eastern, this court explained, quote, as we explained in North American Van Lines, an incentive system designed to ensure that drivers' overall performance meets the company's standards is a form of monitoring, evaluating, and improving the results of worker performance and is fully consistent with an independent contractor relationship.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted. Call the next case.